Well, I'm glad you're in the session, and there is a handout in case you haven't picked one up. You may notice right under the title I have a parentheses there, please do not copy this essay. And the reason I've asked you not to do that is that I'll be presenting this at the annual meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society, ETS, next month. And I want to send Dr. Schreiner a copy before I do that and have him give him the opportunity to respond. And then, of course, we'll try to do whatever I can by way of adjusting after he does that. So this is not quite where I want it to be yet because of that. And I have documentation. I just didn't include it. I kind of ran out of time. I am Bruce Compton. And although I'm old enough to retire, I haven't yet done that. I keep getting asked that question. I love what I do, and I'm grateful that the Lord is allowing me to do it. I serve at the pleasure of the president of our seminary, which is the pastor of our church, so perhaps you should ask him when that day may come. So the title, 1 Corinthians 13, and the cessation of miraculous gifts, I am going to critique Thomas Schreiner's recent volume, Spiritual Gifts, What Are They and Why They Matter. So I say in his book on, by the way, I just finished the conclusion this morning, which means I'm going to be tied rather closely to my manuscript, and you'll be able to follow along. In his book on spiritual gifts, Thomas Schreiner uses the final two chapters to defend the cessation of miraculous gifts. Schreiner is an internationally recognized scholar and churchman and a highly regarded teacher and writer. As a fellow cessationist, there is much in his book that I can applaud, not least of which is his ironic spirit. I think if you've read anything by Schreiner, that comes through quite clearly. Yet there are some significant issues in his defense of cessationism where we disagree, and I want to address those issues in my essay. I begin by briefly surveying Schreiner's case. Following this, I develop my critique along two lines. First, I respond to his interpretation of 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 13, and his conclusion that arguments for the cessation of miraculous gifts from this text are unconvincing. In fact, that's the title of his chapter where he deals with that passage. Second, I assess his case for the cessation of miraculous gifts based on linking the miraculous gifts with the revelatory ministries of the New Testament apostles and prophets. That's where he develops his case for cessationism. Finally, I offer a conclusion on the cessation of these gifts in response to my critique of Schreiner's arguments. Now, I'm going to actually skip the section where I survey his case, if you please. I'm hoping that my critique of his arguments will allow you to follow what his argument is and how I'm responding to it. So we're just going to skip over and jump right to my critique. So that's on page 5, I believe. It is on mine. I hope it's on your handout as well. So, page 5. Schreiner's case for 1 Corinthians 13, this is now looking at his chapter on 1 Corinthians 13, rests on three arguments. His first argument is based on Paul's statements about seeing face to face and knowing fully in verse 12. The perfect in verse 10 refers to Christ's second advent. Neither Paul nor the Corinthians, secondly, would have understood the concept of a canon representing the New Testament. That's, he's responding to the view that I champion. And then thirdly, if the perfect referred to the New Testament canon, that would undermine the imminent return of Christ. I address his arguments in sequence. So the interpretation of the perfect in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 10. I have previously written on this passage and the cessation of miraculous gifts, and my discussion there is reflected in what follows. And I give you a reference there. The three gifts Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 8, prophecy, tongues, and knowledge, all involve special revelation. Paul repeats them from his list of miraculous gifts in chapter 12, verses 8 through 10. And he does this with the intent that the three gifts he mentions in verse 8 represent the entire list in chapter 12. For stylistic reasons, Paul reverses the order of the gifts in verse 9, and he omits the gift of tongues from the previous verse. Nevertheless, what he says about the gifts of knowledge and prophecy is understood to be true of the gift of tongues and the other miraculous gifts as well. As Schreiner notes, the critical question raised with these verses is the meaning of the term the perfect. The term represents a neuter adjective that functions as a substantive. The neuter gender of the adjective is determined by what it stands for, its antecedent. In this case, by the neuter noun in the expression in part. So the word part there is a neuter noun, and the adjective influenced by that is also in the neuter gender. Thus, by using the neuter form of the adjective, Paul signals that whatever the in part refers to, that is partial. The perfect refers to the same thing that is now complete. Since Paul states that the gifts mentioned in verse 9 are in some way in part, the proper way to identify the meaning of this phrase is to ask what these gifts have in common that can be described as in part. As Schreiner notes, the common denominator among the gifts is that they all communicate special revelation. As such, the phrase in part simply refers to the fact that the revelation communicated by these gifts is partial or piecemeal. That being the case, the corresponding expression, the perfect, as the counterpart, must refer to the full or complete revelation of which these gifts contribute their portion. Furthermore, since these gifts are identified in chapter 12 as those God has given to the church, the expression the perfect must, in turn, represents the full or complete revelation that God has decreed for the church. Schreiner's initial objection to this definition is based on Paul's statements in verse 12. He correctly links Paul's declaration in verse 12 that Paul presently knows in part with the in part nature of the revelatory gifts in verse 10. And he correctly identifies Paul's counterstatements about his seeing face to face and his knowing fully with the coming of the perfect. The crux for Schreiner's understanding of the perfect is his interpretation of the expression face to face. He argues from the Old Testament that the expression is used literally of someone having a direct encounter with God. That being the case, the perfect most naturally refers to Paul seeing Christ face to face at his coming. Now, it must be granted that the expression face to face can be used in the Old Testament to describe an individual seeing God in person. This appears to be the case with Jacob's encounter with the angel of the Lord and with Gideon's encounter with the same angel of the Lord in Judges. However, in the majority of cases in the Old Testament, the expression face-to-face is used metaphorically. This is seen in the example Schreiner himself gives from Exodus 33 about God speaking to Moses face-to-face. That the expression is not used literally of Moses seeing God's face is made clear in the verses that follow. In Exodus 33:18, Moses asks to see God's glory. In response, the Lord specifically says that Moses cannot see his face. It would seem strange that Moses would be asking to see God in verse 18 if the expression face-to-face in verse 11 were to be taken literally. From the phrase that follows face-to-face, quote, as a man speaks to his friend, the expression face-to-face is used metaphorically of God speaking with Moses openly and directly. Further support is found in Numbers 12. There God declares, quote, if there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. With him I speak mouth to mouth, clearly, and not in riddles. And he sees the form of the Lord. The expressions face-to-face in Exodus 33 and mouth-to-mouth in Numbers 12 are synonymous. True, God says that Moses sees the form of the Lord in the Numbers passage. But we know from Exodus 33 that this cannot mean that Moses saw God's face. As such, the contrast in Numbers 12 is between the piecemeal and somewhat enigmatic revelation that God gave to the prophets through visions and dreams, and the full and direct revelation God gave to Moses. This appears to be the same contrast Paul echoes in his opening analogy in verse 12. Paul describes the church's perception of God's revelation based on the revelatory gifts with seeing something in a mirror dimly. That is, seeing something indistinctly or unclearly. In contrast, when God's revelation for the church is fully disclosed, it will be like seeing someone face to face. That is, clearly and distinctly. The word dimly Paul uses in this verse is the same word the Septuagint uses to translate the expression dark sayings back in our Numbers 12 passage to refer to God's revelation through the prophets. Thus, consistent with Paul's metaphor, in a mirror dimly, his statement about seeing something face to face simply means to perceive God's revelation for the church clearly and completely. The same can be said with Paul's second analogy in verse 12. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. As with Paul's first analogy, the now-then contrast corresponds to the in part perfect contrast in verses 9 and 10. As mentioned earlier, Paul makes this connection explicit with his statement in the first part, now I know in part. The debate centers on the second half of the analogy in Paul's statement that I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. Schreiner argues that when Christ returns, believers will know God fully, even as God has fully known them. There are several problems with this interpretation. Perhaps its chief liability is that it says too much. It blurs the creator-creature distinction by equating in some way the believer's knowledge of God with God's knowledge of the believer. In fact, several of those who champion this interpretation attempt to relieve the tension by qualifying their interpretation such that the verse does not say what their interpretation implies. The knowledge believers will have of God only approximates the knowledge God has of believers. The problem with this qualification is that the comparison Paul uses, just as, is always used elsewhere by Paul in the sense of an exact correspondence. For that reason, it is best to interpret Paul's second analogy consistent with his first and Paul's larger argument. Applying the point of his first analogy to the second, Paul states that his knowledge of God's revelation for the church is mediated through the revelatory gifts and is partial. As he has argued in chapter 13, verse 10, Paul's analogies in verse 12 reinforce the fact that the revelatory gifts provided only a partial or piecemeal revelation of God's will for the church. In contrast, when God's revelation for the church is perfect or complete, then he, Paul, will know fully what he presently knows only in part. Full revelation brings full knowledge of God's will, just as partial revelation provides only partial knowledge of God's will. To restate the point, Paul knows God's will in a way similar to his knowing or seeing himself in a mirror, that is, dimly or distinctly. When the perfect comes, Paul will know fully the will of God for the church, even as others fully know him. Others see Paul clearly and distinctly, not through the mediation of a mirror. This then is how Paul and others will know the will of God, clearly and distinctly, when God's revelation for the church has been fully disclosed. Schreiner argues that a serious problem occurs if verse 12 refers to what will take place with the completion of the canon rather than with the return of Christ. If this interpretation of verse 12 is correct, then that must mean that we who have the completed canon know more about God's will for the church than the Apostle Paul did. After all, Paul declared in verse 12 that his knowledge was only in part. I wonder if this criticism misses the point of God's giving special revelation through various individuals. Paul perhaps knew more of God's will for the church than anyone else in his day. Yet that does not mean that he knew everything that God chose to reveal through others, like Peter and John. Peter, for example, stated that there were things that Paul wrote that he found difficult to understand. I've always agreed with him on that. The point is that no one apostle knew all of God's special revelation for the church. God gave much to the Apostle Paul. God gave some to others. So yes, since we have the completed New Testament canon, there is a sense in which we know more of God's will than even the Apostle Paul knew. Schreiner argued that neither Paul nor his readers could have understood the concept of a canon representing the entire New Testament. For that reason, the perfect in verse 10 cannot refer to the New Testament. The principle behind this criticism is that a text can never mean what it could never have meant at the time it was written. This is a legitimate criticism if those who levy it against the above definition of the perfect would demonstrate how it applies in this instance. Rather, the evidence argues that Paul and his readers were familiar with the concept of a completed, self-contained body of special revelation from God. In other words, while the term canon may not have developed until after the first century, the underlying concept was familiar both to Paul and his readers. This can be seen from Schreiner's interpretation of Ephesians 2:20, the key text in his defense of cessationism. His argument is that once the foundation for the church has been laid with the New Testament canon, then the revelatory gifts that build that foundation are no longer needed and pass away. As can be seen, Schreiner defines the foundation in this verse, Ephesians 2:20, to refer to the completed New Testament canon, and I concur with his definition. My question is this: how can we have Paul refer to the completed New Testament canon in Ephesians 2:20 and yet deny that Paul could possibly have meant that in 1 Corinthians 13:10? If Paul can refer to the canon of the New Testament in Ephesians 2:20, referring to the foundation, he certainly can refer to it in 1 Corinthians 13:10, referring to that which is perfect. Peter seems to echo a similar understanding in his description of Paul's writings in 2 Peter 3. Peter speaks of Paul's letters that suggests that they have been copied and collected and available to both himself and his readers. Furthermore, Peter places Paul's letters on a par with, quote, the other scriptures. The term scriptures Peter uses is the same word Paul employs in 2 Timothy 3:16 to describe the canonical writings of the Old and New Testament. How is it that Peter can understand Paul's letters to be part of the canonical scriptures and not Paul? If Peter understood the concept of a canon that included Paul's letters, then so can Paul. All of this is consistent with what we find in the Jewish literature of the Second Temple period from approximately 400 BC to AD 100. Several of these authors refer to the Old Testament as a self-contained body of writings that were the product of prophetic revelation from God. They note that true prophecy had ceased and that God was not adding to what he had already revealed through his prophets. They say this even though Jewish literature flourished throughout this period. Furthermore, these same writers also note that God had promised in the future to revive once again the voice of prophecy, but that he had not yet done so. In short, these Jewish writers recognize that God had authored an authoritative body of revelation, that this body was a self-contained identifiable entity, and that this body of revelation had been closed in the sense that nothing further was being added to it. That being the case, there is no reason why believers in the first century would have struggled with the concept of a biblical canon as an identifiable body of special revelation given by God or with the concept of a completed canon. The principle behind Schreiner's argument here is that the New Testament teaches the imminent return of Christ. Using Schreiner's definition, imminence means that the Lord could come back within the lifetime of each generation of believers, including the first. Furthermore, when the Lord comes back, he will remove believers from the earth, translating those alive and resurrecting those who have died. This event is referred to as the rapture of the church. To restate the point, there is nothing in prophecy that must precede the Lord's return to rapture the church in the sense that each generation can hold out the hope of the Lord's return. The principle of imminence is derived from verses in the New Testament that speak of Christ's return as at hand, that his coming is near, and that he is standing at the door. According to 1 Thessalonians 4:17, Paul apparently held out the possibility that he would be alive at the rapture of the church. Paul says, "And we who are alive and remain will be caught up." And according to our interpretation of 1 Corinthians 13, Paul also held out the possibility that he would be alive when the canon was complete. "Then I will know fully as I have been fully known." Paul speaking in the first person. Based on the principle of imminence, Schreiner sees a problem with the interpretation of the perfect in 1 Corinthians 13 to refer to the New Testament canon. He notes that the New Testament was not completed until the end of the first century. Thus, had Paul and the Corinthians understood that the New Testament canon must be completed before the Lord return, well, that rules out imminence, well, at least for those living in the first century. If that were the case, then those living in the first century, like Paul, could not expect the Lord to return in their lifetime. However, as Schreiner notes, the Lord did not reveal to Paul when the canon would be completed. Assuming the completion of the canon preceded the Lord's return, that's my one typo that I've seen. If you see others, let me know. Apostrophe S, let me read that again. Assuming the completion of the canon preceded the Lord's return, Paul apparently did not see any conflict with the possibility that both could take place within his lifetime. The exact timing of each was unknown to Paul. Thus, from Paul's perspective, the completion of the canon, like the Lord's return, could take place within his lifetime. In sum, God has fixed the time of the Lord's return and for the completion of the canon. However, God has not revealed the exact timing of either of these events. According to Paul and the other writers of the New Testament, both events could take place within the lifetime of each generation, including the first. The fact that the canon was not completed until the end of the first century, or that the Lord has not returned after 2,000 years, does not jeopardize the principle of imminence. I want to make one more point with Schreiner's interpretation of 1 Corinthians 13. Schreiner has argued that the case for the cessation of the miraculous gifts from this passage is unconvincing. I would like to argue the opposite point, namely that apart from this passage, a convincing case for cessationism cannot be sustained. Schreiner recognizes that whatever the perfect refers to, Paul appears to say that all of the spiritual gifts continue until the perfect comes. However, based on other texts, he argues that the revelatory gifts and likely the miraculous gifts ceased with the completion of the New Testament canon. I see two problems with his conclusion. Assuming for the moment that verse 10 allows for some of the gifts to cease before the perfect comes, the verse does not seem to allow the miraculous gifts to be among them, as Schreiner argues. The gifts Paul specifically mentions in verse 10 are all miraculous gifts involving the communication of special revelation, as Schreiner acknowledges. So how is it that the miraculous revelatory gifts can cease before the perfect comes when these are the specific gifts Paul says will continue until then? Beyond that, Paul's argument on the cessation of the miraculous gifts in verse 10 involves a cause and effect relationship. The indefinite temporal clause, when the perfect comes, then you have the main clause, the partial will pass away, can only mean one thing. The coming of the perfect, the cause, results in the passing away of the partial, the effect. In other words, there can be no cessation of these miraculous gifts until the perfect comes. The significance of Paul's construction is simply this. You cannot have the perfect refer to the return of Christ and have these gifts cease before that time. Paul's grammar simply does not allow for that. Schreiner's case from other texts, that's where he goes to establish his case, rests on two arguments. According to Ephesians 2:20, the revelatory gifts of the apostles and prophets laid the foundation for the church, the foundation being the New Testament canon. With the finalizing of the canon, these two gifts, along with the rest of the revelatory gifts, ceased. His second argument from these other texts, he says the primary purpose of the other miraculous gifts was to authenticate special revelation. Thus, with the completion of the New Testament canon, both the revelatory gifts and the miraculous gifts have ceased. I treat these arguments in sequence. I agree with Schreiner that Ephesians 2:20 provides a convincing case that the gifts of the apostles and prophets ceased with the completion of the canon. Once the foundation of the completed canon was established, then those laying that foundation would no longer be needed, and these respective gifts would cease. According to Paul's analogy, you can lay a foundation, but you cannot add to the foundation once it has been laid. Thus, the gifts of the apostles and prophets, which laid the revelatory foundation for the church, must cease with the completion of the canon. That being the case, I also agree that the completed New Testament canon remains the sole and final authority for faith and practice for the church. The antithesis would be, if these gifts continue, then the canon as the foundation is not closed but open, and the New Testament cannot be the sole and final authority for the church. Furthermore, if the argument for the cessation of the apostles and prophets based on a closed canon is valid, as we have argued, then it must be valid for all of the revelatory gifts. We cannot have one or more of the other revelatory gifts, like tongues or the interpretation of tongues, still operating and maintain a coherent defense for a closed canon. The tension I see with Schreiner's case is with the miraculous gifts that do not involve the giving of special revelation. He mentions the gifts, the gift of healing, as one example. While Schreiner is not dogmatic about these gifts, the non-revelatory miraculous gifts, he's not dogmatic, his argument is that the non-revelatory miraculous gifts function primarily to authenticate the revelatory gifts. With the ceasing of the revelatory gifts, the miraculous gifts authenticating these would cease as well. So that's really the heart of his argument on these other miraculous gifts. Their primary purpose was to authenticate the revelatory gifts. With the ceasing of the revelatory, they would have ceased as well. I'll pick it up there. The question here is not whether God can and does on occasion perform miracles. That's not the question. The question is whether the miraculous gifts themselves are still operating. Schreiner acknowledges that these miraculous gifts had other purposes beyond their authenticating the revelatory gifts. He mentions, for example, that the miraculous gifts provided encouragement, comfort, and joy in response to the display of God's power. Rather, his argument is that the primary purpose of the miraculous gifts was authentication. For that reason, with the ceasing of the revelatory gifts, the miraculous gifts ceased with them. My criticism of Schreiner's argument here is twofold. First, how convincing is the case that the non-revelatory miraculous gifts have ceased if they had purposes other than authenticating revelatory gifts? If their sole purpose was to authenticate the revelatory gifts, then I think the argument would be airtight. When the revelatory gifts cease, the miraculous gifts of necessity ceased with them. But if they had other purposes, then what prevents them from continuing to function in fulfillment of these other purposes, even after their primary purpose has ended? Returning to Ephesians 2:20, my second criticism is that Schreiner allows for the gift of prophecy to continue until the canon had been formally recognized in the centuries following the first century. He correctly holds to only one kind of New Testament prophecy. Like the Old Testament prophets, the New Testament prophets gave special revelation that was inspired, inerrant, and divinely authoritative. However, having the prophetic gift continue beyond the first century and beyond the completion of the New Testament documents raises questions. In what sense was the canon closed with the completion of the New Testament, when New Testament prophets continued to give new revelation? Also, if the gift of prophecy continued through the first few centuries, why did the early church not recognize and include this new revelation with the rest of the New Testament? In sum, the combination of a closed canon by the end of the first century and the ongoing gift of prophecy beyond the first century appears irreconcilable. Conclusion. I have argued that the case for the perfect in 1 Corinthians 13:10 to refer to the New Testament canon is convincing. Furthermore, any defense of the cessation of the miraculous gifts that identifies the perfect in 1 Corinthians 13:10 to refer to the return of Christ faces significant problems. Finally, I have also argued that the case for the cessation of the miraculous gifts based exclusively on linking the miraculous gifts to the ministries of the apostles and prophets falls short of convincing. Thomas Schreiner is an honored brother in Christ and a valued colleague in the cause of Christ. I have learned much from his writings. His Irenic spirit when disagreeing with a fellow believer is exemplary. Our disagreement over the evidence for the cessation of the miraculous gifts is significant. At the same time, we have much more in common in our faith than the few places where we disagree. My interaction with him on this topic has served to sharpen my own thinking, and my hope is that it will do the same for others.